start our meeting. I want to welcome everybody. I'm extremely pleased, the Commissioner, that you've come with your team. I'm just assuming that it is quality more than quantity in terms of the team, and also to all the members, thank you for coming on time. Just to set the context, for the past 18 months we've been, or however long we've been in office, we've posed questions, did oversight, made observations, asked for clarity, and in many instances we received clarity, and in many instances we asked for you to go back and and give us more clarity. For 2010, this is the last time that we're going to have an opportunity to meet in this fashion. And therefore, after this meeting, all questions that members might have, I'm appealing to you to seek solutions to them, because we will then write our report for the year. We're not going to have another opportunity in 2010 to have this type of an interaction. And I do know that wise men like Mr. Abram have criticized us in the past of doing oversight, doing recommendations, writing reports, and never ever following them up. So this is what it is. It's really a follow-up on all the burning questions that members have. I'm hoping that members will at least remember some of the pressing ones you have. There's a presentation that will jog your mind on others, but I'm sure everybody here has that one or two questions that you need answers on. Members will recall that at the last meeting, we had asked the department to go back because we were not satisfied with the preparations that the department had done. I need to just indicate to DCS that you really have got 2 weeks. You really have got two meetings in which to convince this department to support whatever budget proposal you bring. We're in the process of doing budget reviews. We have promised from the beginning of our term that we will not accept a budget that doesn't talk to the white paper. We've said that from the beginning of the term. And we are probably on track to be the first committee that will force the hand of the executive. We'll probably be the first committee that will force the hand of the executive. So I do think that the department has an opportunity now to have a frank and open interaction with us, to give us your challenges. We are going to meet, I think, tomorrow around the financials for the previous year, but we're more interested in what you're doing going forward. I do know you have a presentation, but I do think so that we have a more fruitful interaction. I'm going to start off by asking members to interact with the department on those issues that you felt strongly about up to now. We'll give you about 10 minutes to interact with the department, and if what you're asking is covered in the presentation, the department can refer us to page 1 or slide number 1 or slide number 2. If we did it the other way, the department will take the first 2 hours, and then we will only have an hour to respond. So I'm allowing you to do the initial, the department will respond. And on any matter that is stuff that we have asked the department up to now, the end objective is that when we meet tomorrow and when we meet on our own, that we are able to take an intelligent decision around the budget and be able to defend it wherever it needs to be defended. So it's not a matter of grilling the department, but it's a matter of ensuring that they are accountable and also ensuring that when we do our own deliberations around what we think the budget should be or the adjustments, it'll be informed by our interactions for today and tomorrow. So once again, welcome to the department and to everybody else. Many new faces here. So maybe we just need to introduce each other very briefly so that we know who we're talking to and we know who is here. So I'm going to start at the very end from the members, and then Commissioner, you'll lead us and your team. From the very end, Mr. Abram.
Shalom, Abram. Thank you. Leonard Max.
Connie Bly, Noma Kayam Tara, Eastern Cape.
The Benton Fisher. James Self.
Nyanda Florence.
Mpoma Tabata.
Cindy Bali.
Thank you very much, and those are members of Parliament together with our support staff, and it's multi-party DA, COPE, and is that it? IFP haven't joined us today, but at least it's DA and COPE that are with us. Let's hand over to you, Commissioner.
Thanks, Chair. We'll start at the extreme end to introduce themselves.
Ruben Mburi, Legal Services. David Chilwane, Remuneration Control.
Nandi Marika, Financial and Management Accounting.
Robert van Androot, Facilities.
Jenny Bauer, Acting Regional Commissioner, Gauteng.
Taxi Lovana, IT.
James Malberger, Regional Commissioner, Western Cape.
Linda Bond, Human Resources Development. Good afternoon, everyone. Sebastian, CDC, Chief Deputy Commissioner, Development and Care.
CDC, Omit Chwana.
Stuart Fokera, the Chief Financial Officer.
Tom Mayani, National Commissioner.
Tiko Mbambo, Deputy Commissioner responsible for intergovernmental relations. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And the young lady that's sitting, can you introduce yourself, please? Thank you very much, Ms. Paliso. Let's kick off. You've got 10 minutes. Anybody who wants to take the first bite of questions from members, or am I ambushing you?
No.
No.
Chair, can I just get yep. clear in my mind? Are we going to go right through this presentation, or should we do it section by section?
I had suggested that members initially have 10 minutes to ask questions, whatever's on their mind, because there are many questions. If we want to do it section by section, that's also fine. But then if we do section by section, then I suggest that we're not all going to ask on section one, because it'll take us forever. But I thought initially if you wanted to take the first salvo and ask that pressing question, hopefully it's covered in the section, and we interrogate it, because we have many items that are outstanding. And I think we're all of one mind of those items. We can always cross it out as we go along the line. So I don't want it to be too formal. Ask your question, seek your answer, and let's get going on that one. Now, everybody's got about 10 minutes initially, and then we'll ask the department to then go through whatever we've not covered. So I'm allowing you the first bite, Mr. Self, and then after Mr. Self, we'll ask Ms. Ngwenya, and then Abraham. Mr. Self, you've got about 10 minutes to deal with the department, and we'll take Abraham and Ngwenya.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks to the department. I mean, there's a lot of information here, and I thank them for it. If I can just deal in the first instance with the legal claims, and I have two questions related to that. The first is, and I think it may relate to a bit later in the presentation dealing with the analysis of debt accrued by staff, what attempts are made when staff are involved in, are responsible for the claims, what attempts are made to recover the costs from those staff? And secondly, in respect of legal claims, there is a case going on I'm aware of that is not mentioned here, and that is the case related to a claim by Royal Sachaba against the department for in respect of the award of a contract. Now, that doesn't appear to be part of this. My understanding is that there was a legal opinion to the effect that the department should not contest this claim. I understand that the National Commissioner has taken a different view. I would like to know what the basis of that was and why the legal opinion is not valid, bearing in mind the authors of that legal opinion. All right, so that's the one thing.
Important enough. Let's take that one on legal, because I heard Mr. Mbuli is here. It's been years that we've been waiting for Mr. Mbuli to come and talk to us. So if you could answer those two as a department, and everybody else that has a question related to legal will they then be able to pose their question. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair.
Just a minute, Mr. Mbuli. Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee, I should think it is appropriate and it is correct for me as the head of the institution to make a profound apology for having not attended the previous meeting. Secondly, I also want to take this opportunity also to make a profound apology for sending us packing in the last meeting because of poor quality of the presentation. We have taken cognizance of the unhappiness of the Portfolio Committee. May I assure this committee that we take your work seriously, and we can assure you here on record that it shall not happen again in the manner in which it has occurred. It is my firm belief, Chairperson, that as a department we can only become strong if we work with you together. We can achieve more in terms of the gaps that are identified by your committee and being able to address them very frankly and openly. It is my belief, therefore, that it is good and correct for us to make that statement upfront and clear. I brought with me, Chairperson, the team that I believe is not only numbers, but it is quality that goes with it. We have attested to the fact that you have been waiting for Mr. Mbuli. I should think he's the right person to deal with issues of litigation. I applied my mind in terms of the people that I needed to bring here so that we can clear the path together and be able to be guided by yourselves in order to make this department a department that is taken with seriousness and with respect. Before we get into the issues of the presentation that is and the questions that are going to be raised by members, may I hasten to raise the following, Chairperson, as my introduction, because it is important for me to assert this upfront. Chairperson, for a long time, we've been failing your department, your committee, for a number of reasons. And having applied my mind, I've discovered that Department of Correctional Services, in pursuing and responding to the question raised by this august organization and your committee, is that we've always relied on junior staff to put responses to the questions that are raised by yourself very seriously across to us. Without due attention to quality and content of what the issues have been raised, which means, therefore, we have not given time to issues ourselves as leadership as to whether the responses that we give to you contain content and quality. If there are situations wherein we feel those issues are not addressed, we should be able to address them here. I therefore believe, Chairperson, that the issue of compilation and collation of information that we have attempted in this instance certainly goes a long way to meet what you might call minimum requirements to the organization. But I would like to hasten further to indicate that after this meeting with yourselves, with the questions and the quality of responses that you may provide yourselves, we'll be able to write back a similar compact that was presented to yourself in a qualitative manner, bound in a manner that you'll be able to have it for a long time in your archives. It is not only the quality, it's also the aesthetics of the document and the way we present ourselves to yourselves. I therefore want to make that admission that it was wrong for us not to be able to take issues in the manner they're supposed to be. I've said to yourself, Chairperson, and the members of the Portfolio Committee, that we're not going to use BOT as an excuse here before our time. We have a responsibility to change this organization into an organization that you do give respect and you'll be able to listen to. The second issue that we have as a problem, as an organization, is the way we package and we put together our reports to yourselves. This is a big challenge. I should think this challenge predates ourselves here. And we want to make good out of this meeting today, that we live in the full knowledge of the fact that it is not words, but it's our action in terms of what we provide this committee. The other issue that I have noted as the head of the institution together with the team is that we have a problem of coordination. Chairperson, when this committee addresses us and gives us tasks, it is important that we take note of the fact of the seriousness of the issues that you are addressing with us. We take time to look at the matter of the portfolio committee with the seriousness that it deserves. We think it's one of those committees, and we do not give due respect. I might be wrong, Chairperson, but I'm speaking on behalf of my colleagues sitting with me here who have taken note of that. The fourth bullet point, Chairperson, it says portfolio committee issues or matters are not given serious attention and sufficient time. Indeed, it is important that we take acknowledgement of this fact, that we be able to give issues that are addressed by ourselves to us with sufficient time and deliver timeously. I would like to tender my apology for sending you documents in a fax form or email form. That is not the correct way to address yourselves. I want to make a humble appeal and request to pardon us for this, because I took a decision when I looked at the manner in which the documents were compiled that this is not what quality that I expected of my team. And we implored with Ms. Cindy Bali here that please, ma'am, accept our apology. We'll send the documents in the manner that we have. I've already indicated that in the next interaction in the future, that documents will have to be compiled properly, professionally, so that you have sufficient time to interrogate the contents of those reports. Chairperson, we are not undermining your organization under my leadership. We'll give you due respect for the work and the task that you've been mandated by the state. Finally, we have 5 months at the helm of this organization when we took over in May. And therefore, it is bound to happen that we will not be able to address some of the issues myself at the helm of the organization. But I can confidently indicate to yourself that I've been able to embrace the organization, understand the challenges and the nuances that happen within the organization itself. And therefore, I will not have any other excuse under my belt to say I am not well aware with the current events within the organization. I'm appealing to yourself to give me an opportunity and a chance to address the challenges that I've been able to identify within the organization. I've worked with your team in the last 5 months in the manner in which we were, and we believe that you'll be able to give us the support that is unreserved. And therefore, based on this, I would like to inform this committee that in the coming months before the end of the year, not financial year, you shall be able to see drastic restructuring within the organization that seeks to speak to the issues of making this organization to be functional, not dysfunctional. We therefore request your support and indulgence in making our efforts of a turnaround strategy that seeks to speak to the issues that are close to your heart and the mandate that has been given by yourself by the Parliament. Chair, these are my opening statement with respect to this organization. It is not an easy organization. It's an easy organization that has been set under conditions of difficulty, and we deal with difficult matters, which is of public safety and security of our people. I'll therefore, Chairperson, to thank you very much for accepting us in this meeting. Hopefully, we'll be able to meet the requirements that seeks to speak to the issues that you have addressed to us, bearing in mind that it's not a committee that sits in the office. You have visited some of our facilities, so we're not speaking to a committee that is not aware with the environment in which we operate. I therefore would like to request Mr. Dr. Mbuli to respond to the question that has been raised by Mr. Self in respect to the issues of litigation. With those words, thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mbuli.
Thank you, Chair. There are two questions that have been asked. One is about claims that arose out of the conduct of staff. The question is, what happens to those claims? And then the second question is about the Royal Sechaba motion application, which is pending before the North Gauteng High Court. I'll start with the first one. The department has given a directive to legal services, and this is what we do. If a member of staff of the department causes litigation, and as a result, the department pays money or is exposed to legal fees, once we apply the principle of vicarious liability, we have to recover the money that has been paid through the negligence of the staff member concerned. There are exceptions in the law where the staff member could not have forfeited state cover. I won't get into those niceties, but the directive, and which is in line with the policy of the department, is that if a staff member causes litigation, and as a result of which the department is brought to court and is ordered to pay, we claim from the staff member. It has happened in few cases now. I won't mention the names, but it is Limpopo. A staff member caused litigation, and we have instructed the state attorney to issue summons, and we are prosecuting that matter. In other words, we are trying to recover. And there is also a case in the Eastern Cape region where staff members assaulted inmates. We lost a case, and we were in the process of recovering the money that the department has paid because of the negligence of the staff member. In other words, it's not just business as usual. You cause litigation, you face the consequences thereof, subject to certain exceptions as a result of law. For example, you may find a case where a staff member causes an accident, he drives a motor vehicle, and in terms of the law again and the treasurer regulation, the staff member does not forfeit state cover. In that case, at last, we can't recover there. But where state cover has been forfeited, in terms of the law, that is the directive also given to us, we have to recover via the office of the state attorney. So there is no doubt about that. Every time we handle litigation cases, we pay particular attention to whether there is a staff member responsible. I think that was is in order. You will note, Chair, that I'm referring to cases that have reached the court and have been finalized. Before a case is finalized, it's not possible to have a decision this way or that way. But most of the comments on litigation, on claims, is set out in the presentation, which I won't get into now. I was merely responding to our question. Now, I'm coming to the second question. The second question, unfortunately, I cannot answer it directly. For the simple reason that there is a principle in our law that says if a decision of a court is pending on a matter, you are just not free to comment on it until the court has given a ruling on that matter. For example, see, I can tell you that the matter, the motion application by Royal Sechaba Holdings, PTOR LTD versus ourselves and the other parties, is pending before the North Gauteng High Court. Not only is it pending, the parties have exchanged pleadings, they've been filed, they're on record, and we know the date of the hearing, which is 7 and 8 February 2011. We know the time, it will start 10 o'clock in the morning on both days. I'm not sure whether the judge president is going to change the judge that is presiding. Eddie said, I do have a name, but I'm withholding it because I don't know, because he's not yet seized with the matter because he took comments on that day. So, unfortunately, because of the principle of sub judice rule, I cannot go into detail about that.
Sorry, Mr. Mbuli. The question is, why are we defending? Please respond to that.
Chair, let me respond to the reason why we are responding without touching on the plea. There are certain allegations made by the applicant in this matter. One allegation is that the department, not the department, but the body that selected evaluated the bid, aired in disqualifying the applicant for not submitting a particular document. And based on the information that we have now, the document was simply not there. Because the document was not there, our view, and we think the court will decide, and I'm not going to get into detail, is that the department did not air because the document was not there. There are certain reliefs that the applicants want. They want to set aside the award of the tender for reasons that are not clear, because we are of the view and we have been advised by a competent legal team that there is nothing untoward in the process that was followed by the committee that set to evaluate, and the other committee also in awarding the tender. So that is a matter of dispute. I won't get into the views of different witnesses, because that's a matter which will be a credibility finding by the judge that is going to preside on the matter. So we are waiting for that decision, but we are confident that there's nothing untoward that was done. Because if the tender processes and procedures...
It's okay. You say there's nothing untoward done. Mr. Self, do you want to follow up on that question?
Mr. Self comes into... Chair, I would like also to make a correction. As the National Commissioner of Correctional Service who assumed duty on the 15th, I did not... I should think that's the angle with which the press has attributed this to me. I found the matter already on the table. It had already been decided. The decision of defending the organization on this matter had already been agreed upon. And this matter also was referred to SCOPA in the meeting that we had with them. The National Commissioner, Tom Moyane, did not in any way change the decision of the organization. The decision to defend the Royal Sechaba case precedes me. And when the matter was brought to my attention, duly informed, I concurred with the rationale under which the conditions for that decision was taken. Because it gave an impression that within 2 weeks of joining the organization, without knowing the nuances and the problems within the organization, I took an uninformed decision. And therefore, I want to clear my name on this matter. Because the Royal Sechaba matter was 2008-2009. I only joined the organization in 2010. So I want the committee to support me on this matter and defend my integrity, because it gives my integrity, as if without due respect and attention to matters, out of the blue, I decided to change a decision that has not to defend. Chairperson, that was my angle because this was in the public domain. Thank you very much.
Chair, there's just one other aspect, and thank you for that explanation, and I absolutely accept the National Commissioner's word on that. And that relates to the legal opinion that I believe was obtained by the department by two eminent advocates to the effect that the action should not be defended. Was there such a legal opinion? And may we see that legal opinion? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, it is correct that there was a legal team that was handling the matter, and then the legal team in question gave an opinion. But when we interrogated the opinion, there were certain aspects that we were not happy with, for the simple reason that it was written before the staff members were interviewed, the staff members on whom the opinion is speaking. So I did meet one of that legal team. I found it difficult to sell the idea to the department because they didn't meet with the department. The consultation did not take place, subject to several attempts that we made. But when the opportunity came, then we insisted that, look here, we are consulting on this matter so that the department can give you very clear instruction on it. Then the legal team sent an SMS and they indicated that they were unavailable. And because they were not available, we had, as a department, and I fully recommended that as a person in the legal desk of the department, that if an advocate, senior as he may be, he is, I agree, fully, I respect, voluntarily says, I'm not available, and he sends me an email, I'm bound to find an alternative which I presented and then we briefed the alternative. Equally capable, and they reviewed the papers. I won't get into detail. They interviewed the staff members of the university, sorry, not university, the department, and understood the facts and circumstances under which the tenders were evaluated and eventually awarded. And we are of the view that there was nothing untoward. And that is why the matter is being defended without getting into the merit and not also getting into criticizing the former eminent legal team. I mean, we fully respect it. The only, I want to clear this very clearly, the only reason why they pulled out is because they were not available. That is a normal excuse for any practicing advocate.
Thank you. Thanks, Chief. Thanks. Mr. Bully, let's put this thing to rest. You see, we operate in the real world, people on the side of the table. Now, we've heard horror stories about this tender. Horror stories about this tender. Mr. Moyani is saying to us that he was not responsible for the decision to defend this matter. Mr. Veko says, as far as we understand, was in support of the department not defending this matter. The only common denominator in this whole thing from 2008 and 2009 is yourself, because there's new people. No problem with that. What we are saying to you, sir, if this matter goes to court, and the department then is found to have been in default, I'm putting it on record now. We're going to ask you to resign. You to resign, Mr. Mbuli. I want you to understand that, because this matter is such a serious matter. We are saying that because our view, and when I started off, I said, I'm glad you're here. Our view is that that legal department is totally inadequate. That's our view. The legal department of correctional services is totally inadequate. You are now saying to us that from your observations and everything that you've done, you are very confident that there is no basis for this thing. I hope that is the case. If there is a basis, if it is found that the department was in default, bearing in mind that there's a legal opinion that Mr. Self is talking about from two very eminent lawyers that we would have rejected as a department, there's horror stories from members of parliament that you are saying, no, not you, but I'm saying the sense is that there are no basis for these horror stories because the department did everything correctly in appointing these for SASA for the stand. If that changes, we are going to ask you to resign. That's how serious we've become. If the department suffers any losses because Bosasa won that contract, as the head of legal, we're going to ask you to resign. Are we clear on that matter, sir? If you have anything else to say, you will interact with me afterwards. I don't think there's time anymore in this department, certainly not from legal, for us to dilly-dally. There is no time to dilly-dally. Some of us have reached a point where we just think that this legal department, Mr. Moyane, must be reconstituted. That's our view. That's our view. So we are putting it on record now. If there's any cost to the state because of this Bosasa tender, Baba Uzobaya, I'm saying that to you. Not a threat. It is a commitment from this department, from this committee, on the Bosasa matter. Because we've heard horror stories, and if you want to share those horror stories with us, you better share them with us so that we'll tell you what we have and reassess if you need to reassess. But I just find it extremely, extremely difficult that a department comes here and says to us, we've looked at all the matters, there's nothing to worry about, we are defending it. Two senior legal people say, look, there might be a problem. Sobeco says there might be a problem. You come and you say, ah, no problem. We'll defend it. It's fine. She's of course. I will make it my duty to fire you. I will make it my duty if there's any cost to the state on this one. Mr. Self, do you want to carry on anything else on legal? Are you happy? Before anybody else wants, before you come in, anybody else on legal matters?
Okay, it's partially legal.
That's fine. Let's take Abraham and then take Ngwenya.
Chairperson.
Okay. Chairperson, in the press today, there is a report. A certain person who has been incarcerated for a couple of years, well, it's public because it was in the paper, Dion van Deventer, is apparently a key witness in some other trial. And that this person has been visited by certain individuals in one of our facilities, and that the facility does not seem, according to the report, to have any identification of the people that had visited this person, to threaten him not to give evidence in that case, which has to do with Rhino Horn and poaching. Otherwise, his life and that and the safety and security of his family will be in jeopardy. So, Chairperson, I would like to know, when anybody wants to visit an inmate, what is the procedure? Don't you get to see the person's ID? Don't you get to take his address and details, the visitor, before you allow the person access to such a visitor? And my second and last one for this round, Chair, in the press recently, it has been reported that a certain inmate injured himself in prison, that is our Clive Darby Lewis. Issue here is not who it is why. That is the question. This person was denied access to proper medical care, and the person's family had to apply for a court order to get him removed in order to obtain medical care. Now, Chairperson, as I say, there are hundreds of others there who may not have the financial resources, who may not have the ability to be able to seek a court order to be given proper medical care. The issue is, if what we read in the papers is true, then this is a major breach of one of the tenets of incarceration, and that is that we are responsible for the well-being of every inmate. And my problem, sir, is not the question of who it is a question of why, if the newspaper reports are true. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Salf has covered me. Also, Chairperson has covered me. And I think on what I'm going to say, maybe I'll repeat it again, Chair, when they finish to make the presentation. Because on what I'm going to say is also linked with this problem of BOSASA. Chair, in terms of this thing of legal, I think this thing is there's long time goes on. And we as this committee, we talk about people that whom we don't know, that the department has failed even to come with the presentation of this business people or service providers. I think another solution that we need to do, we need to allow this BOSASA to come in front of this committee to make their presentation, because there are a lot of questions that we need to ask them. Chairperson, there's a lot of money that have paid by the department, but how can we pay people whom we don't know? That what are they doing, and what are they doing with our money? Is what I want to say, Chairperson. Let us allow this service come in front of this portfolio committee, make their presentation. Then we can say this is wrong, this is right. I don't know this BOSASA. I only hear about this BOSASA on the paper. ANC didn't teach me to believe on what I heard on the paper. But now we want to get the truth, because it's long time we don't get the truth, Chair. So for us to get the truth, can we allow this BOSASA to come and make a presentation in front of this committee? I thank you.
Finally, Mr. Bulli, if I can just, you know, on page 9 of the presentation, unlawful detentions, 176 million. Going back to 2004, my question to the department is, I would have assumed from where I'm sitting that unlawful detention would be a matter for SAPS more than a matter for corrections. We're sitting with the liability in our books. Please clarify that for me. Why is unlawful detention a correctional services matter and not a SAPS matter, unless I'm not understanding it? That's the first part. But the second part, if you move two pages to page 13, sir, you know, there's a, on the conclusion, it says all claims which are older than 36 months and where no summonses have been served will be written off at the end of this financial year. So it seems to me that there is a benchmark of if 3 years nothing has happened, we'll write it off, which I totally agree with. But of the 176 million, there's stuff that go back to 2004 and 2005. Can I assume that those 2004 and 2005 is because summons have been, there's work that's been done on them, or is it just matters that are outstanding? In other words, can we clean the book of all matters that have lapsed? Can we clear, if possible, let's clear all these things that have left so that what we see in the book are matters that are a genuine risk. And then, of course, my first question is, unlawful detention, how do we get involved as correctional services?
chairperson, before Dr. Mbuli deals with those questions, could I go back to the issue of the Royal Fitzhaber case? Because I think that there are certain principles that need to be quite clearly understood. The Commissioner has already indicated that a decision had been taken prior to his appointment. It was taken on my watch. It was a very carefully considered opinion. It was, as Dr. Mbuli has indicated, on the basis of us having taken very careful stock of the information at our disposal within our department. The opinion had not been based on the interaction with our members of staff. In addition, I want to state very clearly that legal services is not the place in the department where the mandate for whether a case gets defended or not is taken. That is a managerial responsibility. So if the decision to defend a case is an inappropriate one, it is a non-functional management responsibility and not the legal services department. We are convinced that we have a defensible case. There are certain elements in which we feel that there are Treasury guidelines that leave some areas of interpretation open, and we hope that the court process will close those elements. But fundamentally, on that 2018, do we believe that we have a defensible case, and we've taken that decision after very, very careful consideration.
Before we hand over to Mr. Bui, let's understand something before we withdraw our promise. What is the mandate of legal? So can we understand what is it that the legal department does in this department?
Chairperson, from where I'm sitting, the mandate of legal is to be able to give us legal advice, is the one element to it, or to source legal advice where it is not within the capacity of the legal services department. The second leg of it is obviously on the basis of a mandate from management, on the basis of that legal advice, to then be able to ensure that the necessary process is taken forward, to defend a case, to not defend a case, to settle a case in whatever form it is. So there is a combination of responsibility, one, to advise managers and to ensure that we take legally defensible decisions as managers, and secondly, to be able, once the mandate has been taken, to be able to implement the necessary processes through the state attorney to counsel or in whatever form is appropriate.
For the record, Ms. Reiner, did Mr. Mbuli and his team advise you to defend this case?
There was a process in which legal services and non-functional managers met together and in a process of deep interrogation determined that we will defend this case.
That's fine. As far as we're concerned, then, we are still saying that if this case is lost, Ms. Reiner, notwithstanding the accounting officer's decision to finally take the decision, we would expect that a legal department would be able to, without fear or favor, say to you, this thing is not defendable or this thing is defendable. If in doing their duty they failed you, as we think they're going to, Mr. Mbuli's department will confirm that it is not adequately sourced, and we will take action against it. That's what I think we are saying. That we, if you are saying that they have been party to this thing, we believe that department is not adequately resourced, this is going to be a test case, and on the basis of that, we will then take a decision, because we really do not believe that they are adding value to this matter. We don't believe it, and we have reached the point where somebody has to take responsibility for this matter. Somebody has to take responsibility. It's not about which case it's about. It's about whether legal is adding value. And we're going to go through the entire process. We'll deal with care. We're going to deal with security. We're going to deal with internal control. Because ultimately, our budgets will be informed by what we think the department is able to deliver. We're not going to give money to legal if legal can't perform. We won't give money to care if care can't perform. So we are saying we're going to put our money where our mouth is. Legal, in our opinion, should be advising you as to the winnability or not. If legal has concurred with you, then somebody must take responsibility. And I'm sure that members are supporting this thing, because we've discussed this matter for a year. We've discussed this matter. Mr. Mbuli, when I started, I said thank you that you've been here, because we've been waiting for you to deal with this and similar matters. So thanks for the clarity, Ms. Schreiner, but we are adamant. We are adamant that if there's a cost to the state because legal hasn't given you advice. Or if there's a cost to the state, our first port of call is going to be the Legal Department of Correctional Services. And Commissioner and senior management we will deal with as we go along. But the first port of call is going to be the Legal Department. Next up, Commissioner.
Thanks, Chair. As the official head of this institution, we have taken note of this. My team and I will look into this matter, the seriousness that has been imposed on us. I have concurred with the decision that was taken by my predecessor based on the reasons that were given to me. I therefore equally will share the same sentiments as Ms. Schreiner, who will take the matter forward together with you, Chairperson. I will therefore request on your permission and indulgence that issues have been raised with us on the issues that we need to address currently, coming from Mr. Abrams, Mr. Ngwenya, and yourself. I therefore request the following, that Mr. Bauer responds to the question of how visitors make visits to our facilities, what processes are followed. Once he's exhausted that particular aspect, he will exhaustively, Chair, I'm underlining exhaustively, respond to the question of Darby Lewis. Because this organization is not going to be a sacrificial lamb on issues that are not substantive, which are in the public domain by the press. We have a right and a responsibility to respond to yourselves, who will in turn defend the image of this organization, hence this interaction. I therefore request on Mr. Bauer to respond on any of Mr. Bauer or Mr. Smallberger, one of the two, on the process of visitation, identification, and processes. But on the question of W. Lewis, I therefore request and demand that Mr. Bauer responds exhaustively on this matter. So that when we leave here, there are no questions raised and there are no uncertainties about this matter. I did respond to Afikulume last week Sunday that the matter is closed in business as usual with respect to him. Thanks, Chair. Please speak to the speaker, please.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to ask the RC Western Cape to deal with me, to assist me. He will do the visit, and I'll do the extensively then on Clive Tavi Lewis.
Thank you, Chair. I will be very brief in terms of the identification. I think the question is valid. Important to say that all visits, I'm referring now to not official visits like the portfolio committee and magistrates and so families of offenders, all of them, policy is clear, they need to be identified. We are keeping record of the information, name, address, and other details, also the ID number. That is also available on record. So I'm not having the information that the honorable member was referring to. But this is the policy. In terms of official visitors, there's also proper record in the department, and we do have that information available. So, Chair, in a nutshell, we don't have uncontrolled visits to offenders. There is proper record, and records are available for verification. Thank you, Chair. The power.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to respond on the Darby Lewis issue. Firstly, I just want to explain what happened. Mr. Darby Lewis injured his leg over the weekend, bumped his head, a leg, while walking in the corridor was against the bed. Then he went to see the doctor on the Monday. A sectional doctor from the Department of Health saw him, examined him, gave him some medication, and also referred him for x-rays for the Friday. Basically, what happened, he was supposed to go on the Friday. That was postponed till the Monday. He was visited by his wife on the Sunday, and she was not happy with his condition. Further to that, she applied for a court order on the Monday for Sir W. Lewis to be seen by his private doctor. She wouldn't have had to do that because it's within our policy. She didn't have to go to court to see his private doctor. Based on that, he was taken to hospital, and we explained the procedure to them, the mere fact that he could go and see his doctor. That will get uncosted. It's within our policies, and we acted accordingly. I think I also want to comment on a few issues. As you're aware,
his lawyer made quite a couple of comments. The first being that he's being chained to a bed on a daily basis, and I think that's normal procedure. Also, one of the first things here, you're aware, 2 years ago, Para, we had an escape where offender was chained to his bed, a very highly trained military background, and according to the doctors, he was so ill that he couldn't go and even bath himself, that he had bathed by nurses at 5 o'clock in the morning with curtains around him. We had members on duty. On that specific day, we had an official on duty, and at 5 o'clock in the morning, when he was too ill to go to the bathroom and being chained to his bed, the official went to the toilet in the space of 10 minutes, doing his normal payments of the toilet, if I can call it that way. And while the curtains were closed, he escaped. And we were embarrassed as a department for our negligence in this matter, where doctors said he is too ill to bath. So I just want to say it's normal procedure to chain a person to a bed. We're not chaining to the leg that's sore, it's to another leg, etc. The issue of having three guards was highly criticized, Chair. Now, we must understand that I'm not only responsible for looking after this as a point of view, looking after Mr. David Lewis. I'm also responsible for his safety, because there's people out there that are not happy about what he did. Therefore, we must make entirely sure that if nothing happens to him from the outside as well. I want to clarify the matter, and I want to say all the issues in the papers is being broadcast by his lawyer. We did not really respond till the other day, because we were following the policy procedures. You'll also be aware on the day that he was operated, his personal doctor made a very big story about the issue that we want to be present while at the theatre area, while he's in the operation. That's done in procedure. Anybody that goes to theatre, officials must be there. In this specific hospital, from a security point of view, there's a door on the other side. Not to say that a sick or ill person will escape, but we have to comply with security regulations. That's why we have to be there, and it's in all cases. When you go to Barra, these things are happening. If we go to Barra right now, I will tell you that all people are chained. I mean, that's a normal procedure. I want to go further. There was also a report that a doctor wanted to see him and we refused. Now, Chair, when do we refuse? We don't refuse his doctors and nurses that we know work with in person. But when somebody rocks up and he says it's a doctor and you can't identify why, what, where, when, my officials will not allow the doctor until we have instructions from the specialist or the person in charge to take it further. I also want to take it further. His lawyer came there and wanted to visit him. And I want to talk about visits. His lawyer came to visit him with a food parcel and papers. Now, the policy is quite clear. When you're in hospital, it's like you being in correctional facilities. There's policies in terms of visits. If you want to visit, you contact the head of the center. The head of the center will inform instruction, and then you're allowed to have a visit. That is normal procedure through the head of the correctional center, Mr. McTune. Chair wants to state it quite clear here that the acting area commissioner, Mr. Tana, went backwards. He spoke to the wife and said, "Ma'am, if you feel because his condition is not right for you and you want to visit with more, we'll make concessions," which we did, and we have a record of that. So we did bend over to make visits. We did not allow anybody to come there because anybody can come there with food and say, "This is food for him, and tomorrow he's poisoned," what then? Then we're liable for that as well. I think I've been through basically all the issue about the cost is quite clear. We have hospitals, we have competent doctors, we have had how many hundreds and thousands of offenders that went to Barra, that went to Kalapong, that went to all our hospitals which we normally go to. And those people came back there. So if you want, according to policy, to want to your own specialist in your own hospital, you're liable for those costs. And I just wanted to make that clear. I don't know if there's any follow-up questions. I can carry on, Chair.
Somebody wants to talk to us about the unlawful detention. Why is this correctional services and not SAPS?
Dr. Mbuli?
Thank you, Chair. In our law, the police will arrest a suspect and is put into our facility. Then, if there's a claim of unlawful detention, usually the SAPS, the Department of Police, will be the first respondent. And the Department of Correctional Services will be the second. Because we are keeping him in our facility, that's how we are addressing to this matter. That's number one. Number two, if an offender is sentenced to a period of incarceration by a court of law and he has lodged an appeal against conviction and or sentence, and he's not on bail, we keep the offender in our facility because of the warrant.
and wait for the outcome of the appeal, but there are so many facilities in the country. So when the appeal is successful, let's say the conviction and sentence is set aside on appeal, the register of the High Court must send an information to us and say, release this person because his conviction and sentence has been set aside by a court of law. If we don't receive that, we continue keeping the offender because we've got a valid warrant to keep this person. So when this offender takes us to court, he will cite the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development as the first respondent because the register of the High Court didn't send a letter to us to tell us to release this person. And because we've been keeping this offender, then we're dragged into it. Well, I don't want to go into specific case, but that's the principle.
That's fine. Let us just understand it again from you. You see, I'm 100% behind you. We're dealing with taxpayers' money here. And, of course, there's no expense at this point. But if you are saying that we are respondent number three behind Justice and SAPS, or whatever the case might be, the question that I'm asking, Commissioner, is shouldn't this liability be a Justice, or are you saying that Justice provides for this, SAPS provides for it, we provide for it, and my question is, if all of us are providing for the same case, is that the way we should be doing it financially? That's just the question that I'm asking, you see, because this is an annual report. If my mother read this report when she's alive and she sees that the state is technically has a liability of 100 million rand, she'll faint. She'll faint because this is what this annual report shows us, that if business stopped today, the state correctional services is liable for so much money. So my appeal is, let's clean this thing up as far as is possible. Let's not mislead the public. When I say mislead the public, deliberately or otherwise, because we can't all provide for it. Not SAPS, Justice, and correctional services. Amongst yourselves, you must decide who's going to provide for this money, so that the South African public sleeps easy at night. A contingent liability of 900 million rand that we always hear about when we talk to you just makes this department uneasy. It makes us uneasy because what it means in layman's language is that the worst case scenario is that we must pay 900 million rand if this guy wins the case. That's what it means. So that is why I was asking the question. I take it that we are accused number three, so to say, but can I ask you, CFO, that you guys just find a way of making sure that it's not duplicated? Can we move on to the next set of questions? Anybody, and it's anything. Oh, Mr. Abraham.
Okay. No, I've just got a follow-up, Chair. I want something back in writing, that's all, Chair.
You see, Chair, the press makes allegations, and I understand that if one looks at the profile of the person, they will look at all avenues to accuse the state and state institutions that he is being victimized. They look for that excuse. Can we have a full report on this particular issue? My main concern is that are there other people that require a particular form of attention, medical attention, and that if they don't get it timeously, it could lead to other complications for them. And we want to see that that sort of way is clear, that they are given that kind of attention. Regarding this other issue, Chair, fine, I don't expect the Western Cape RC to have all the information. But this is on the first page of the Burger today, Dion van Deventer. And that's the allegation, as I put it before the officials. They must go into this matter and make absolutely sure whether the allegation that's being made in the paper, Chair, that people were allowed to go to him, and when the inquiries were made, the services could not provide details of those people. And this is a high-profile case, and it may fall through because this person is now afraid to come to court. So we cannot allow justice to be delayed because of some or other mission, and we want a full report on that one too, sir, to come to the committee. Thank you.
We
Thank you, Chairperson. I think Chairperson has exhausted now on this matter. I think now we need to go to this.
I thought you were on follow up. If you're not on follow up, it's fine.
I don't have follow up.
No, it's fine. Would you respond to Mr. Abraham, and then we'll move to the next agenda. To the next matter.
Thanks, Chair. We have taken note of Mr. Abraham's issue and the concerns that he has raised. Certainly, within the standard operating procedures within our facilities, I'll mandate and request Mr. Bowers to look at this article and follow it appropriately. And certainly, we'll provide with the responsible responses that are appropriate with this matter. So we'd like to close this matter at that note, Chair.
Mr. Abraham, I have noted you as the second person after Mr. Self. I know you got very involved in Mr. Self's question. Was there something else that you wanted to discuss or put on the table?
Oh, me,
sir? Yes, sir.
No, not at this point.
Not at this point. Mam Gwenya?
Not on this one.
On the? No, I'm not talking about this one. I'm saying when I started, Mr. Self was the first one, and then Mr. Abraham had said he'd want to contribute, and then you had said you want to contribute. You still want to know, sit down, it's fine. When you get there, we are offering you an opportunity to discuss with the department. Anybody else wants to engage with the department on any matter whatsoever that's on your heart, anybody.
Including what's in the responses,
yes? Yes, that's what we talk about, on any matter. So we're noting you, Mam Gwenya, and then Uba Abaga. That's right. On any matter in terms of the responses, Mr. Abraham.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I've noted the responses with regard to the escapes at Harrismith. And the responses, Chairperson, basically only tell you about what has happened, how many people have been rearrested, and that's where it stops. That's not what we want to hear, Chair. What we want to hear, Chair, is how are you going to stop a similar thing happening again? And I'll tell you what one of the problems there are. I've been to the facility. The problem, sir, is that it is basically a remand detention facility. There are a minimal number of sentenced inmates, and that there are it's a rural area. There are several feeder areas where the people are remanded from, and the problem there, sir. This sort of thing will happen again. Problem is that they don't have sufficient officers. And that is a major problem there. And that is nowhere recorded here, sir. All we have is 27 of 41 escaped. So many were recaptured. They're incarcerated. They remain incarcerated at a certain place. Cases to be heard in court on 30th September. Internal disciplinary processes to be updated in the meeting. Now, Chair, I want to request that this is not the kind of responses that we expect. I mean, this sort of thing is no good to us. It tells us nothing. Because the argument here was that what were the circumstances that led to these escapes? And you need to give us a rundown on what actually happened. This means nothing. I mean, it's common knowledge that people escaped. It's common knowledge that they will be, some of them will be rearrested. It's common knowledge that they'll be incarcerated. What we need to know is, why did these people escape? What actually happened? What were the circumstances that led to it? Thank you, Chair. All I say, Chair, is this is not sufficient. And I think on this one, too, Chairperson, I want to request that a full written report be given to us.
No. Letter of written report is what has killed this committee. We want the department to answer. What happened? What is the lessons that have been learned? And who has taken responsibility? We don't need a written report. Senior managers are here. Talk to us about that particular incident. Anybody else wants to add to the Harrismith one specifically? Otherwise, we'll ask the department to respond as best they can. Anybody else wants to add to, or Mr. Abraham covered us on the Harrismith one? Thank you. Can the department respond?
Chairperson, when the incident occurred on that fateful evening, I can't recall the date, I was 31st of May. I got a call
and an SMS from Mr. Modiso, who is the RC for Free State and Northern Cape, that he had just been informed as he was driving from Gauteng to Free State himself that an incident of this nature had occurred in his area, and he will be changing direction and go directly to Free State Northern Cape himself, Clary Smith. I then informed the minister about this incident because he did not have the full details as to how many offenders or detainees had left the facility. Senior management was kept abreast of the developments throughout the night. When Mr. Modise arrived at Harry Smith around 11 o'clock at night, he called me. And he said, preliminary reports indicate that 40 to 45 people had escaped. It was not clear they were still doing their tallies in terms of the people who were incarcerated in that facility. I immediately took a decision that I'll visit the facility at dawn, because that was a mass escape. I informed the minister. The chief of staff, who is present here, was informed about this incident, and he said he's going to accompany me if I was going to drive. The minister indicated to me that it would be unwise of me to drive, therefore we need to get the support of the military in terms of getting a quick turnaround to attend to this matter. We spoke to the chief of staff in the Defense Force, who in turn spoke to the Minister of Defense that a helicopter will be made available early hours of the morning. The minister, myself, the chief of staff, the political advisor, the other team that accompanied us, we flew to Harry Smith on the 5th the following morning. On arrival, we met with the head of the center and those responsible for the facility, including Mr. Modise. The head of the center indicated that he was attacked, he had bruises, and he was in pain. We then requested and demanded that we do a fact-finding mission ourselves, walk into the facility to understand what had happened. In brief, Chair, there was a clear flouting of standard operating procedures within the facility. There is a law that says after lockdown, nobody visits the facility. In this particular incident, there was a lawyer who came after lockdown, to come and consult with an inmate. Over and above that, Chair, another flouting of standard operating procedure, the head of the center has requested those who were in duty to leave early, around 2 o'clock. For uninitiated mind, it is very clear that you cannot do this when, especially when you have problems of staff. You needed to optimize and maximize the potential of the units that are on duty on that particular day. We visited the facility, went to the cell, and interacted with those who were responsible for this. Chairperson and members of the portfolio committee, we were informed in that briefing that the head of the center and his team were informed on Friday that there was an attempt to escape from this facility. Therefore, precautionary measures were not put in place, despite the fact that intelligence report, whatever form report they had in their disposal, to take contingency measure. We informed also in loco that a gun was smuggled in this facility, and therefore it was very clear on the balance of the evidence before us that something was untoward here. We then cuddled around, and also to compound the situation, Chair, it seems as if when you visit, if you recall, Chairperson and your team, when you went to facilities, when we go through one center to the other, they knock. The official on the other side will identify and look as to who is coming. In this instance, all these procedures seemingly were not followed too. But before these detainees left this facility, 41 of them, they even went to break into a tuck shop. Okay. Now, breaking a tuck shop is not a simple, quiet thing. There should be noise that is audible to those who are on the other side of the security perimeter. Strange enough, on this particular day, this was not to be. No one sitting here,
41 people escaping at the same time that you cannot hear when, because there's desperateness on the people on the other side, because in the event that the attempted escape is discovered, they are all going back to the cell. So there was no silence to a point wherein the officer on duty could not hear when they were knocking at the door that people are about to leave. He did not even peep to check. There is no way from that door that you could not see there were a number of people behind that door. 41 people is a big number. On the probability of the assessment that we did, it was very clear, Chair, that we're taking through a memory lane of things bigger than what we expected. The minister and I looked at this matter with the merit that it deserves, that this matter cannot be condoned in the manner in which wherein we shall take people for disciplinary action. This was a clear violation and flouting of the law. This was an attempt that was prepared, incubated within the facility. What made things strange in this incident, the lawyer, when this escape was in progress, she was not hurt, being seen a female, given the fact that a number of those who were incarcerated and about to leave, some of them were murderers, rapists, nothing happened. All they did, she was not even beaten, they only took the key of the car. They did not know as to whether the car, the car keys were for the vans or for her car, whichever. They even went to an extent to take to the, they went to the arsenal, where they called ordnance to take some guns. I think they took one firearm from an officer on duty. For us, as the leadership of that organization, it was very clear that this was an organized escape, and those at the helm were responsible. It was on the basis of what we found on the ground that we had to make summary dismissal of the four people who were responsible and on duty on that particular day. We believe that the decision was correct and well informed, and as we speak today, in interaction with police crime intelligence, they were able to apprehend a number of those who escaped. Some of them went to Lesotho. There was one who was said to be a mass murderer. He was killed on combat when he crossed back into South Africa. Now, Chair, on the merits of this issue, lessons learned is that it is important for us on a continuous basis to do a review of the policies that we implement in our facilities and to hold those who occupy a position of authority accountable for the actions that happen under their responsibility. Lessons learned is that also equally, there were no facilities for them to be able to make contact. The escape was observed by a public person sitting who has a facility, who has a house across the prison. That's how this thing was picked up. But strange enough, those who were manning the main gate could not even identify at that time 40 people walking outside the normal hours of visiting to see that, to raise a panic button, even if he was not armed, to alert those responsible for security to come at his rescue. In short, Chairperson, the statistics, as Mr. Abraham indicated, yes, it's a story that we are painting, but we took a principled decision that we shall not entertain a situation wherein officials operate in the manner in which they did. I took full responsibility of that action after consulting the minister that these people should go. But the case is on with them because it is a disciplinary measure. Besides being dismissed, that is a case against them. Because up till now, we cannot account for those who are not being apprehended. So the matter is still continuing as we speak. The case is not closed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. It shows that on security, we've got a big challenge. And I'm worried, Chair, because the budget that was allocated is about 71,445 million for security. Now, Chair, you may ask yourself, Chair, what is the duty of this CCTV that we are paying for? And Chair, the document also is not clear in terms of how many centers have access control, which are not there.
Sorry, Mangwenya, I know that it's linked, but I just wanted to finalize the Harrismith one. We'll deal with security generally. That's what I was asking. Is this a follow-up specifically on Harrismith one? We'll allow you later on. Does anybody want to follow up on Harrismith specifically, not security generally, on the Harrismith one? But you started it, Mr. Abram. Do you want to talk on Harrismith specifically? Okay, Mamnyanda, then Ubaba Zohu, and then Abram. On Harrismith only, before we talk broadly.
Thank you, Chairperson. My concern is that day, the staff members were relieved to leave the center. What was the purpose? My second question, the lawyer, she herself, what was the motive of her coming in that time? And she was not hurt, and everything was with her. It's a concern, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Firstly, may I get a clearance? Do we allow the lawyers after visiting hours to be the visitors in the correctional centers? If the answer is yes, that those people are accompanied by any officer when they visit these people? If the answer again is yes, what happened to this case? Thank you very much.
Chairperson, you will need extra personnel in facilities like this. And you've got to look at that very seriously, not only at this one, nationwide. Thank you.
My one, before you respond, I'm happy you're saying the case is not closed. My question is, why can we not proceed with criminal cases against these individuals? You see, it's one thing to say that an official of correctional services did something wrong, so let's fire him. But if he's done something wrong that could warrant a criminal charge, why are you guys not charging them? Dismissal for me is not a deterrent enough. If this is a criminal case, firearms have been stolen, so he's been an accomplice to these things. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm sure I could make up a case that says that you are, by association, part of this thing. There's guns that have been stolen, people have left this place, and all we do is fire him and probably give him his pension at the end of the day. Why can't we procure criminal charges, let him go and sit behind bars? Because that's something that you must defend. You are defending other matters, but these matters, we just say, okay, I can go ahead and leave it like that. Why are we not pursuing criminal charges? We know who they are. So those are the questions. If you could respond to those questions, we'll move on to the next one.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I should think Mr. Abram indicated that this is a remand detention facility. When we have an opportunity to discuss on remand detention, we'll be able to expand appropriately. We have a serious problem in terms of remand detainees, because when they are released, when they come from court, there is not clear classification to us on reception as to this group here, this number. There were so many murderers, we have so many rapists in this situation. Chairperson, I'm saying this in passing so that when we get to that particular aspect, we can have that. Because on the morning on arrival, there were four offenders who had just arrived in the morning. Two of them were for heists, one for murder, and one for rape. Chairperson, that facility is not meant for this type of people. And therefore, we were in discussion with SAPS and other law enforcing agencies that when people of this nature are transferred or taken to our facilities, we should be informed in advance so that we can make proper preparations in terms of this type of people. It is very clear on the list and the type of profile of the people that escaped that evening that we're dealing with high-profile criminals and that this facility had no ability to take care of them. It's our responsibility, but it's a matter that we need to address going forward. Chairperson, issues that are raised here is that the motive was very clear when the head of the center
said you may leave early. Very clear. There was motive that was unclear, but to me and you sitting here, it was something untoward was going to happen. Secondly, the presence of the lawyer, it is allowed by law that they can come and consult. They are allowed. But as to whether they can allow, they are allowed to come and consult after hours is a different issue. We were informed on this particular incident that the lawyer, the lady, was coming from Bloemfontein to come and consult on a high court case of an offender that was incarcerated in that particular cell. So there might have been an exception to the rule, given the fact that she was traveling long distance. And therefore, there was a need for us to be able to facilitate the process for her to be able to do her duty. So let's accept that probability. As to whether she was involved in the commission of crime or planning, we don't have a clear picture on that. But, Chair, responding to your question as to whether criminal charges have been pressed against these officials, I would like to take a pause and say I'm not sure, because it's a number of things. I should think there is a legal process that is taking place. Whether it's a criminal case against them, I should think we'll come back to you on this matter. We did not, for the sake of expediency, say you are dismissed and therefore the matter is closed. There is charges that are pressed against them from a perspective of the law that they should be accountable. If they are found guilty, they should be sitting behind the bars. So that's the principle, Chair. But let me allow myself to interact with legal and the team to see how far we've moved on this, as what type of charges that were pressed with the police, because we raised this matter with the police again against these people. So that's the issue that we'd like to address to yourself.
Chair, just to add, I'm not going to comment specifically about Harry Smith. I assume that that is the way forward. But normally when we have such situations, we do open up such cases. You've used one example in my local area. I think you're aware of the Lacotte, the well-known Lacotte case a few years ago when SAPS bogus officials came to take out Lacotte. And we did a joint investigation with SAPS, and we found that one of our officials at our gate was accomplished. He aided in this escape. He's currently serving a five-year sentence at Leeuwkop. We also had, at the beginning of the year, the official that was caught bringing Dacha in at medium D at Johannesburg. He's also been sentenced recently. He's also serving a five-year sentence for smuggling in of banned substances. So, yes, we do this with the police, and these cases go to court. We testify, and we have a record that people are sitting behind bars at the moment. Thank you.
Find out about the ones who were at the gate, saw these people going out. What happened to them?
Mama Nabonje, the one at the gate, the one who was behind the main security, the head of the center, there were four, I can't recall the other one, but all of them are involved, man. So there is a case against all those who were on duty at that time. So it's not a question of selective as to the head, but all those who were involved in this process.
Thank you, Chair. You know, there was a case at St. Albans prison one time of a high-profile prisoner who had made about 9 escapes. He was serving about 500 years or so. We saw him, we were looking at him at St. Albans prison. I said, why do we keep such dangerous criminals here? Now, what happened is that usual prisoners, when they go to a court, that's the time they tend to escape, and we're doing that. You know, he was usually escorted by the army soldiers when they sent him there. He was a very dangerous chef. Then, ultimately, we suggested that there is a need of a court in the prison itself. Like ultimately, they've got a court there where these serious offenders are not allowed to go outside prison. Yeah. Now, also, it's not wise to have these dangerous criminals in these instead of the ultra-maximum prison, like the Simex prison or Cockstar prison, it's safer than these other ordinary, because these chaps, they have a lot of plants. They can easily bribe the waters and all that. Yeah. I think that's another problem.
Very much. There are more comments and advice. Mam Gwenya, and then followed by Baba Zo.
I'm covered.
Mam Gwenya on... No, oh, you covered. No, we're saying on, not on responses. I thought you wanted to... Any matter, Mam. We're giving you an opportunity.
Okay.
And then Ruben Dovo, and then Leonard Max.
Yeah. Chairperson, I've got two matters. One is on security. And two is on the... Scotland parole process. In terms of the security chair, I mean, but I'll only ask the question. I want to know, chair, how many centers have access control which are not working, and when will this be fixed? I'm saying this, chair, because if you can go a post-mortem, you'll find that access control has been terminated 2009, if I'm not mistaken, on September. And you'll find that company, Busasa, was having 800 staff there, and the department was having 500. Staff. But if I can ask you, Chair, where are the staff right now? I want you to go to Cosmo, like Susan, and check what are they doing. That cameras are not working. And Chair, it's like a TV. I'm worried about that, Chair. So that's why I want clarity from the department. Ukuthi zolungiswana yini lezi zinto. Ngoba phela imali yona lokhu iyaphuma. Okwesithu, Chair, we have asked about iphezulu. I'm still on a security check. You'll correct me. Also, even kule phezulu. Still, Chair, we're talking about people that we don't know. We're saying we want the department to tell us who is Pezulu. How much is the department spending on Pezulu? The report doesn't have all those answers that we're expecting them to give us. And also, Chair, on security. I even ask again about Isondon that is paid more than 3.5 million per month. Who is this Isondon, Chair? So, Chair, I'm still going back on what I was saying at the beginning that I said this thing is ngasosonkisikhathi with another one. That for us, Chair, to get the truth, We need to know these service providers that are servicing our department. Without doing that, Chair, we're always asking questions and not getting the right answer that we must get. I'm passing on the security, Chair.
The security, Ma. You'll be the first bite for the new one.
Okay.
Any matter around the security infrastructure and so on, anywhere, if members want to follow up. On security, basically. Let's take Mr. Self and then Mam Nyanda and anybody else on security.
Thank you, Chair. Some of the questions that I had have been covered already, but I would like to ask, first of all, around the shareholding of Sondolo. We seem to have a shareholding of Pezulu, but not of Sondolo. Secondly, I'm a little bit confused. I have to tell you about why at a particular point the access control points were decommissioned or put out of operation, and then some of them are now in operation. But we're talking about a period of 2 years to decommission. commission and then recommission, and we're talking about a quote that was given for reactivation of the control rooms given by Sondolo at 6.8 million rand, and the reactivation, in fact, internally is going to cost 166,000 rand by all accounts. Now, it would seem to me if that's the escalation that Sondolo was charging on a simple reactivation process, what is the scale of fleecing that's been going on in terms of the original contract? In other words, how inflated is that price? Finally, Chair, I'd just like to know, over and above anything else, the issue of these the access control. What happens if there is a fire in one of the prisons? Is there a way in which one can evacuate the people concerned through a turnstile system if there's an emergency of that nature without large-scale loss of life?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to find out what will happen after the maintenance contract or on the 31st March 2011 of the access control system. Who's going to be in charge? Who's going to control? Because the contract is ending on the 31st of March. I just want to clarify.
Yes, Ma'am Palisa?
Chairperson, mine is this Sondolo. It's for a long time we are grappling with this Sondolo. I just want to know whether, when we were visiting Jefferson in Durban Westfield, we had a concern that Sondolo was not working, and Sondolo was paid by our department. But at the gates, we came across a Mahane boy with a lock. And not Sondolo. So I just want clarity because I can't read, because the documents also came late to us, Jefferson. It was also late to us, so I could not read where the CCTV cameras and Sondolo was not working at, in our facilities. Whether are they fixed? Did the department fix the control cameras were not working? I want to know that because we are confronted with this case because cameras are not, Sondolo is not working for us. We are paying a service that is not giving service to us. It is giving half service, but is fully paid. And that is a concern of unauthorized expenditure. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, to add my piece before you move on again on these two, because that's the theme we seem to be going on. You know, on page 20 of this document that talks to Sondolo, 88 million rand was the contract cost. It included installation, commissioning, access control, and all those things. 88 million rand. And then, of course, the monthly fee was 3,576. 3.5 million rand on page 20. I'm sure you're following me.
Yes.
Mm. Now, somewhere, as Mr. Self said, a decision was taken to decommission. The question that I'm asking, was the monthly maintenance cost reduced accordingly, or did they continue regardless? Because if they continued regardless, it's number one of unauthorized expenditure. The second part that I want to talk to is, on page 21, the executive management took a deliberate decision to decommission. The executive management took a deliberate decision to decommission. Somewhere along the line, again, you then say the service provider came back to reactivate as a quote or something. Now, those people that took a decision to decommission this thing, and a couple of months later we must pay for it to be recommissioned, who are those people? Who's that executive management? Because this is fruitless expenditure.
Mm.
And for too long, people have made mistakes I don't know. Let us be honest and frank with you. We think that there is wholesale looting and corruption on these things. I think we must put it to you so that you understand it. We are not going to stop on Sondolo, on Bosansa, on all these tenders until we satisfy, because we think there's a wholesale looting. You decommission, and I suspect that the monthly maintenance continued. Remember that code said this is the monthly maintenance, but we decommissioned somewhere along the line. I would imagine that the maintenance was also reduced accordingly. Then an executive management decision is made, let's decommission. A few months later, let's recommission. All to the same company. Why was that decision taken? And if it was a mistake that is costing us 3.5 million rand a month, I want to know who took that decision. I want to know who took that decision, because the PFMA is very clear, the accounting officer must carry the can. The accounting officer must carry the can for these type of things. This department, when we took over, we made a commitment, Jenny Steiner will tell you. We said we're going to kill corruption in this department, from whichever source it comes from, on Hannes Klamak. And hulle wat betrokke is met die type dinge, saam met die corruption wat ons klaarmaak, moet put te betaal. We can't have a department that is almost stigmatized as being the most corrupt department in the organization, and nothing happens. You decommission by executive, you recommission, there is a maintenance contract that probably continues right through. We're not convinced that we got value for money for this IT system that today. Where we've been, we've never seen one of them working. So if you could answer those type of questions for us, because we're not going to let this thing die. We are not going to let Sondolo, Bosasa, and those things die, not in our term of office. We're going to make sure that we get to the bottom of it. There were many questions asked if people want to respond to them.
Thanks, Chairperson. The questions are very clear, and therefore my team will provide clear responses, and if they find that they are faltering, they should indicate as such. The issue at the core here is security, underlining the factor from the various questions that came through. I'll therefore request Mr. Ngubo to speak to this committee on two, Sondolo and Pezu. Because it is said Sondolo, 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 Sondolo. I'm not sure that this Sondolo, this, that Sondolo. Chair, I want to put a little bit of, but no, these are serious matters. Mr. Ngo will give us a sense on these matters, but most importantly, the question that has been raised by the chair is, if we decommissioned, what informed us to decommission? And then what also informed us also to recommission this. Thirdly, the monthly fees that were they payable when we decommissioned? If they were payable, at what level, at what rate? The other issue is that needs perhaps there's colleagues present here to the shareholding that was raised here of these two institutions. May I then request, and then of course Mr. Jeff Shulvan may want to speak from an IT perspective. Mr. Ngubo, you have to be straightforward, brave, and on this matter, so that we don't have our tongues tied on this matter, because I've heard too much about Sondolo. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe what I need to first say is to talk about Bosasa, and say that Bosasa, according to the shareholding, is the mother company of all these companies. They are subsidiaries of, yes, and I would say including Pezu. In terms of the information that I got, is that although in the sheet that they provided, Bosasa, you would not find Pezu. But Pezulu is operating in their premises, and the management of
Phezulu is also Busas.
What?
So I'm just mentioning that because when I went through the document that was provided, it did not also, I did not understand it until we had to speak to them and find out how do they feature in this. That's when they explained to me that this is the arrangement. But when you look at the director of Busasa, they are mentioned, I don't know whether I can mention their names here, and also the names of Sondolo, they are also there, and also Pezu, they are also there. The only thing that you may not easily see is that one of Pezu, because it is not affected in their structure, but they are all now being managed by one mother company. Now, the question that we are asking ourselves on this matter was that when a supplier or a potential supplier is
I think you've answered us. I think the committee is going to have to sit on its own and look at it, you see, because we are under the impression that it's three different entities. The bottom line is one entity with many names. In my language, it's called fronting. They are fronting. So you've answered our question. I think what we would need to do, Tina, is how do we take this process forward? I think that's what we need to do. But I don't think that us asking questions and getting answers from the department is going to help us any further. Mom and Cordoba.
Thanks, Chairperson. You know, Chairperson, in this case, I think we need to ask Busasa to appear in front of the committee. I think I will support that one. Because really, we are not going to get anything that we want out of the department without Busasa itself. Thanks, Chair.
No, we will have our own internal discussion. Do you want to ask the department?
No. I was just going to ask that if Busasa is the mother company, we also want the child company.
Mom Gwanya, you said one was security, the other one was something else. Let's allow you to deal with the other one. On the security one, I think we will have to take an internal decision as a committee.
Yeah. Thank you, Ken. Yes. Chairperson, we've got a challenge here. When I look at this report, but before I get the report, Chair, I was watching as Kuluma, as Commissioner, was saying. I asked myself that, I wonder, are we going to get the very same thing that I heard on the TV. There was a person that was asking about this parole of Mark Scott.
Costly.
And also, we've been asking the department on our last meeting to come up with the explanation. Because on the questions that we're asking them last, when we sent the department back, this issue was not on the report. But it's amazing to find out now that the department has talked to the community outside before coming in front of us about this matter. Okay, I think this matter needs even the department of it department ga minister also, because there's something that I don't understand on this issue. A person cannot get a life sentence. And when this person make an appeal, get 5 years sentence. And after getting the 5 years sentence, this person gets a parole. And the umuntu obekade eboshwe nayo lo mathebula
Yena ifabula yakhe ingafani, but it's a case where he won. So I understand that this is not the problem of the department, but there's a lot of questions that we need to ask here, the justice chairperson. I'm happy because the department here have come up with all the evidence that what was happening to the parole and the court and whatever. But we still have a question as correctional service. I thank you, Chair.
Anybody else on the Scott Crosley matter? Yeah.
We've had part of the response for the previous round of questions. Are we going to park it entirely?
No, to the previous round of questions.
Yeah, around security.
If you want to have all the responses, it's fine. I just thought that it's a matter that we would need to find an internal strategy. We've been asking questions. These things have been coming out in bits and pieces. Now it's becoming clearer. But if you want a specific answer, then maybe you should ask it. Anybody on the Scott Crosley, Matebule parole matter? It was one of those things that we've raised. Anybody else other than what Mam Gwenya has asked? Nothing? Great. Okay. On the Scott Crosley, Matebule one, I think our difficulty as a committee is that there's a perception out there that if you have money and you're rich, you go out, and if you don't have money, you rot in prison. And it's further complicated by the fact that we're talking about a black man and a white man. And so these are the questions that we have to answer when we go to our constituency. That's why we're asking the question to you. Why is it that Scott Crosley, or let's put it to you differently. What is it that Matebule must do to go out? I don't think it's about Scott Crosley staying in so much. We want to clear these things. If people can serve better time outside, it's fine. But what is it that Matebule must do to get out? Because if there's something that he can do to get out, then the onus is on us to say to him, Baba, do X, Y, and Z. Or is there a fundamental reason why he is inside and the other people are not inside? Or is it just a matter of finances? On the Scott Crosley one. No, we'll get to parole because we'll get to the general. On the Scott Crosley one, so that we are able to answer these questions when they are posed to us. But
on the Mark Scott Crosley issue, I want to request a simplistic response. If it doesn't satisfy you, please bear with us. But I would like to make it very simple for my understanding, perhaps it might be your understanding too. The Mark Scott Crosley issue for us, it's a value chain matter. Police, justice, and ourselves. We're sitting at the end of the value chain with a mandate to incarcerate and to enforce the decision taken by justice. This man was found guilty and was sentenced to life after being arrested by the police with the evidence that they provided. When he was in our facility for the time that he was, with the rights that is given by the state to appeal, he appealed the matter. It went to court as per annex charter to have there. Justice Department deemed it fit from the judge that it's no longer a life imprisonment. When he left, let me give an example. He left Johannesburg prison on that particular day. He was a lifer. When he came back, he was not a lifer. He was somebody sentenced to 5 years. It is not our duty to question the court on the decision that has been taken on a particular case. Neither do we have recourse to ask as to whether the merits and the demerits. When he came back on that day, he was then sent to a facility that is with requisite to the type of sentence that was given to him. Now, following the principles in accordance to the Criminal Service Act, he had the right to apply for parole after serving half of the sentence. Bear in mind, he was sentenced on 2005. Mark Crosley had already spent 5 years around that time. And therefore, he appeared before the parole. By the time the decision taken, it was very clear that he's going to be released based on whatever. But, Chairperson, I should think
the mindset and the perception in the public is out there, which we need to deal with, rightfully so, is that the Department of Justice has to also to be able to present to ourselves on the processes and procedures around the issues of sentences being commuted from a particular sentence to the other. We as a compliant department would like to be able to work within the parameters of the law. Indeed, when we responded to this matter on Asikurumu, we indicated that we're not complicit to his release. But be as it may, there's an issue perhaps that we might need to discuss here, the involvement of the family when he applied for his parole hearing. We have said that we'll go on a roadshow to educate our people as a matter of urgency on the processes and the function of the parole board. Because it's about time that we make it our duty that the issue of parole is properly understood by our people and the involvement of the victim of the family in assisting in the decision taken by the parole body. I'm saying this, Chair, with the full knowledge of the fact that I might be skating the matter on the periphery. But the matter as it is beyond our capability in the sense that the decision taken by the courts need to be applied. Had we not released him, then we'd be sitting with litigation and for him to say it's unlawful detention. And then it comes back to us. Whether as a third respondent or the first respondent, we need to be able to have it as a contingency measure in the event the others are able to defend appropriately. On the issue of Mathebula as to whether what needs to be done for him to benefit from the processes of the law, I would therefore request my colleagues who have been longer in this area and field and competence to be able to provide you with a high-level overview as to what is expected out of him, what is it that we can do as correctional services to help him to understand that he's eligible for consideration for parole. I'll pause there, Chair. Jenny?
Chairperson, thank you. I think that apart from the issue, obviously, of the Criminal Procedure Act and appeal processes, which are an avenue that an inmate can follow to change the length of sentence, leaving that aside, I think that the critical issue in terms of the parole processes is for any inmate, and Mathebula would be one of it, is to ensure that they participate in using the opportunities for rehabilitation within the centre that is provided. In terms of the length of sentence that they've got, there is a particular stage at which they are considered for parole, and his involvement in rehabilitation programs, be they correcting offending behavior, be they development programs, be they care programs, is part and parcel of what contributes to the parole board, the case management committee first, being able to recommend to the parole, here is somebody who has engaged with their offending behavior, has participated effectively in the programs, and is now in a position in which they do not constitute a threat to society, and therefore they can be released on parole. And obviously then also makes recommendations as to the nature of those parole processes. So short of going the route of actually engaging with or challenging your sentence, and obviously there are time constraints laid down in terms of when one can do that, the parole process is a process in which the case management committee recommends to the parole board on the basis of the involvement that the inmate has done in rehabilitation efforts. Obviously, the process of interaction with the victim or the victim's family, in this particular instance, obviously the victim's family, becomes an important part of it because the approach to restorative justice, reconciliation with victims and victims' families, is an important part of an inmate showing the remorse and being able to commit themselves to not going back into that crime process. So effectively, what is faced with, is what Mathebula is facing with, given, I would assume, and I don't have the legal knowledge to know exactly when the appeal time period has gone, but I would think that by now that process should have been concluded, or that time period would have expired. The route that he has is to participate fully in restorative justice with the victim's family, to participate fully in all of the developmental and rehabilitative opportunities that exist within our facilities, and to prepare himself for going to the CMC and from there going to the parole board process. I think that the element that obviously underlies it is that once the courts have actually handed down the decision, the process of being able to, one, understand your legal rights to go on appeal, or secondly, to have the resources to be able to do that is a critical aspect. People do have the right to access to legal aid in relation to those processes. But I think the suggestion that in relation to those elements, justice would be the department that could best assist with it. But internally, full participation within the program.
Let's open it up to parole broadly. It's in Baba Fisla. But I just want to ask the question, let's just get confirmation, Ms. Reiner. Are we correct in saying that Scott Crossley actually interacted with the family? Because you're saying part of the prerequisites for matrimony. Because Scott Crossley went out on parole as well. Now, I'm asking this question because, you see, we had a matter, and I'm sure, Mr. Bauer, you got a call last week about this matter that has been there. In some instances, we insist that we're not going to give you parole because you haven't interacted with the family. In other instances, we give parole. And then a further one is that, well, as a department, we can't trace the family. Now, if you can't trace the family and I'm incarcerated, how am I going to trace the family? So I'm saying don't put conditions that make life difficult for people. That's what I'm saying. When we open up generally for parole, we must be clear on these matters, because if we set conditions that people are not going to be able to attain, then, in essence, we are saying, yes, you're never, ever going to qualify. Who has the onus of finding the victim? If I'm incarcerated and assuming I don't have a mother and father and a brother outside, how am I ever going to trace the victim if I'm the only person? And if that is a prerequisite, then maybe we must say so, because I would argue about it, and that's why I'm asking you specifically. In Matabule's case, you are saying here, the parole board has been requested, or whatever the case might be, to find the victim's family. So supposedly when Matabule goes up, that is going to be one of the disqualifiers, that he hasn't found the family. Has Scott Crossley not set a precedent? If he didn't look for the family and got out, why must Matabule look for the family and get out? I'm saying this whole parole thing has been a big problem for the committee. Every weekend we're getting calls of people complaining about parole. So if you guys can just tell us exactly where you're at, what are the prerequisites, how do we respond to the community out there about parole? Because it's not working as it is currently, because there are just too many things and nobody follows any of them. But let's ask other members just on parole so that you will respond to them. But this was one of them. Yeah.
If I can clarify that, because I don't want what I was saying to be interpreted as interaction with the victim's family is a prerequisite for parole. There are families that do not want to interact with inmates, right? Because it's secondary victimization, it reopens old wounds, we can't insist that it is. There are situations in which you can't trace the victims. The victims were 20 years ago, there was no database in place at the time to track the victims. So it is certainly not a prerequisite, and certainly somebody cannot be denied parole because they have not had the opportunity to interact with the victims. The responsibility is a joint cluster responsibility to be able to trace the victims, and that's part of what we need to establish going forward, is that there's a proper database that draws from the time of the court case a proper database of victims going forward. There is no obligatory process of interacting with the victims. But obviously, where the victims or the family of the victim want to interact or prepare to interact, and the inmate is keen to interact, that is a very strong indication that that is somebody who is dealing with the nature of their offending behavior. That is somebody who is actually prepared to say, I offended, I violated your rights, I hurt you, and I am coming to terms with that process. But it should not be interpreted as it is a prerequisite for. And it certainly is a joint responsibility in terms of tracing it. But perhaps the two regional commissioners can also add in terms of those elements, because they are the people who deal with the actual practical challenges of tracing victims.
Okay, before we go there, only on parole, all sorts of questions that affect or that relate to parole, let's put them to them, and when they respond, they would respond to them in one go. Anybody that wants to talk on the parole matters, yeah, any parole matter for clarity, you have an opportunity.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
Fisla, Abraham, and then Ngwenya.
It's unfortunate that in South Africa, the question of the victim is lightly responded to by the laws of South Africa. You know, in New Zealand, if you commit an offense against somebody in the court, the victim calculates the cost for the offense that you have done to him. And you first, you have to pay those costs, medical or otherwise. If you kill somebody, then you calculate the cost, and you have to pay them before they take any action against you. They sentence you. Now, I was in a church recently. I saw something, I heard something very strange. Somebody who is in prison, I think he's serving, he's a minister, religion, he's serving, he has completed 17 years. Now, he was trying to make a petition for parole. So he was getting, they were circulating a paper that was that is the congregation of the churches to get to support for his release in prison. It was very strange because when I tried to intervene, because you know ministers in the church, very difficult to have the conversation to deal with them, you know, because I said no. This is very strange. I haven't had this thing happening. He said, no, they are trying to send a petition to whether justice or to correctional service about the release of that particular individual because he has already served. I don't know if he was serving 25 years. Now, what happened is that this chair, this minister had a business in Kinglamstown, and some people tried to, they robbed his shop, and then they killed people. And he went there, and he killed them. And he was sentenced to 25 years, I think, by previous regime. Now, churches now are trying to petition for that person, for the release on parole of that individual. It was something I was hearing that thing for the first time. I wanted to intervene to get a clear clarity on this thing. Why are they doing this and all that? Hearing this thing for the first time, petitioning for a parole by a minister.
Meneer Abraham?
Baie dankie, voorzitter. According to the response here, Chair, offender statistics, people that were sentenced for periods up to 24 months. The total number appears to be 12,500. Now, Chair, I don't know what the parole conditions and requirements are for people who are sentenced for periods such as this. But shouldn't the department, in order to also trying to bring down the inmate population and limit overcrowding, shouldn't the department come forward with some other proposals? Because naturally, I mean, a sentence of up to 24 months indicates that the offense was not a very serious one. Whether such people cannot be released under correctional supervision or some other form. We have projects in municipalities. We have government projects where such people can go and serve for a few months in order to compensate for not being in prison. I don't know, Chair. Can't we be innovative in that regard? And secondly, Chair, with regard to paroles, I think at some stage or the other we had asked that people who are terminally ill,
that we be given some or other indication of what is the extent thereof in terms of numbers, and whether some or other form of consideration should not be given that such people rather spend the last few years of their lives with their families, so that the responsibility of taking care passes on from us as a state to that of the family. I don't know, Chair, whether these things are worthy of responding to or are worthy of some or other consideration. But I personally believe, Chair, that the punitive aspect was in terms of the fact that the people had to serve some or other period in prison. And now they are terminally ill, whether one should not seriously look in terms of the sort of offenses that they had committed. And of course, this issue of people incarcerated for up to 24 months. I believe, Chair, that we can make use of those people in terms of some or other municipal projects, government projects, in assisting some in some or other form, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think here I'm going to have comment and question. My comment here, Chairperson, is that I think that it's also important to identify challenges faced by victims in participating in parole board. My question, Chair, is that does the department call the victim when a person supposed to get the parole? Because I don't get a sense that Mark Scott Scottley was giving a parole. But I don't get any sense to say he was the victim was there to allow them to give him parole. That's why I said maybe, Chair, we need to have a clear policy on this thing of parole. Another question, Chair. I want to know that has the department done a research on challenges faced by the victim? And what assistance is given to the victim currently to ensure that they participate in the parole hearing? Chairperson, another question in terms of the parole. I want you to know, Chair, how many parole board offices were completed in 2009-2010 financial year. I thank you.
Department?
Thanks, Chair. I should think with respect to the offender serving less than 24 months, I would ask my RCs, either Mr. Bauer or Mr. Smallbagger, to respond to that. And then thereafter, I'll cascade the responsibilities of responding to other questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chairperson, I'll briefly respond to the comments on offenders serving less than 24 months. In very brief terms, instead of the CMC Case Management Committee submitting the recommendation to the parole board in cases that is serving longer than 24 months, the cases less than that is going to the head of the center. In other words, the head of the correctional center do have that responsibility for the shorter terms. In terms of the prerequisite, it's mainly the person must have a monitorable address. In other words, you cannot put the person in the street. And the basic terms of half of a sentence is also applicable on them. And what we are experiencing is that although the figures that you are seeing seems that it is people who are serving a short term, but a lot of those offenders are also having further charges for other offenses. In other words, if you need to appear in a court of law and you don't appear on that day, you might be arrested then for contempt of court. Then you are doing, for example, 30 days. You will be reflected as if you are doing less than 24 months. But parole cannot be considered because you have also a warrant, for example, robbery. So, and also, what we also see, if you peruse through the document, there's also a lot of offenders that are being released, and then they are committing minor crimes, and then they are doing a short sentence, but also parole break. So in other words, the offender did have an opportunity before, but then haven't used that opportunity for various reasons. So in short, Chair, can I say that the offenders between 0 and 24 months are also being considered for parole, and there's many of them that are being released. Maybe just a comment on the issue of the victim empowerment. One needs also to emphasize the matter that victim empowerment is a new focus of government. The leading department, which is the Department of Justice, and SAPS and Correctional Services are also partnering in this process. During September, for example, in the Western Cape, it was also published widely where the three departments as a collective had a meeting in Elsies River, because that is the area that was identified as the most victims of crime are, where the three departments went there, there was a meeting, and then distributed pamphlets to many households in that area as a matter of sharing the victims' rights, because it's clear that the victims are not aware of their rights. And that was a process started to share with the victims what are their rights, because clearly the 8 rights that they do have is not known to the normal person in the street. I can confirm, as Ms. Reiner was saying, it's not a prerequisite, and there was a question, who do have the responsibility to trace the offender or the victim? It is the case management committee. If you look in the case of Mark Crossley, you'll see, I think it's page 20, that the parole board have given the responsibility to the case management committee to trace the victim on behalf of Matabula. So it's not the offender's responsibility. It is the state's responsibility. Either DCS, if we don't have the information, we can also liaise with other departments. But I can also confirm from experience that the records don't have all the victims, and it will be a process. And I think we need to monitor the process in terms of the numbers who are involved in parole sittings. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, before we terminally ill, on the monitorable address, I should think we need to unpack that also, because we have a number of our people who stay in squatter camps, in informal sector. The minister, in her quest to address this matter, has said we cannot only depend on monitorable address in the conditions of South Africa. We need to be creative in terms of looking at what other means of tracing those who are on parole in terms of to see whether they comply with the process. We are looking as a department into traceable processes like monitoring, like electronic processes that are used in other countries. These are processes that we need to follow as time goes on, because there is gadgets in the market, and there are processes that we need to follow whether they're in compliance with the law. Because to restrict people because we don't have a physical address, it might not be good enough for us in the medium long term. So I just wanted to indicate that monitorable address at the moment, yes, it is, but we need to find other means of creating avenues of releasing people to avert the question of overcrowding in our facilities. So there are technologies in the world, so we don't need to invent the wheel on this matter. I would therefore request colleagues Bauer to take the other aspect further. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I think the RC Western Cape summed that up perfectly. But if I can just add, remember, it was always 12 months, and then it's been amended to 24 months. So it's a bigger period, and more people can then be seen by the head. And then what we do in regions, we have measures in place on a monthly basis to check, are there anyone who had a date who was supposed to be out? That it must explain why and what's the reason. So we do monitor it. In terms of victim empowerment, stroke restorative justice is a very sensitive issue. In terms of tracing the victim, the RC summed it up 100% there.
But we link with SAPS because you've got to go and find the investigating officer and find where's the victim. Now, I think the case that you mentioned, it took us very long to find the victim. When we eventually found the victim, the legal commission. When we eventually found the victim, remember, was murdered, the mother. The mother was married again now to a lawyer in Vereniging. When we contacted the husband, the lawyer, he said, we don't want to open up old wounds. We don't want to see you. He said, can we have a follow-up meeting? So we went yesterday, Tuesday, and they prepared to put up an affidavit that they want to close the subject. They don't want to be part of it. We must go ahead. Also want to, other, you know, some, especially the high-profile cases in terms of victims become sensitive to us as Area Commission. I'm speaking now as Area Commission and not as Acting RC. I want to take the Dr. Kumalo issue that you're aware of, very, very sensitive. And the only person that could come in was Doctor himself. And since before the World Cup, we asked Doctor to come in. He said he's too busy. World Cup's too busy. After World Cup, too busy. Every commission has a decision. We can't wait for Dr. Kumalo forever. We have to proceed. So these are the situations we're sitting with. Then we must understand that with victim empowerment, it's a very emotional issue. Once we receive the victim and we're going in that process, it can take weeks. Follow-ups and follow-ups till you get to a stage where the victim feels that I can, that the perpetrator is showing remorse and I can forgive him and now we can go ahead. Yeah. So I think those are the elements that takes time and makes it very sensitive. Thank you very much.
Chair, we have not responded on terminally ill. I'll therefore request any of the colleagues sitting here, Jenny or... Yes, Jenny.
Chairperson, I think we don't have the accurate figures of the number of people in our facilities. We can certainly provide that statistic. But I think that we have already indicated to the Portfolio Committee that the process of amending the policy in relation to medical parole, so that it no longer only relates to people who are terminally ill, is a process that is going to involve amendment to the legislation. So it will go through that process. So the time frames for being able to implement that are slightly longer than we had anticipated because we'd hoped that it could be adopted through a policy. But it does need the amendment of the law. But that has been through the NCCS. The NCCS has developed proposals that have been submitted to the Minister and they will go through that route.
Chairperson, I think it's a matter that we need to brief you adequately. This matter also has been raised with the JCPS cluster or the DGs because it involves other line ministries, justice and police, so that we have an understanding of the compassionate issues that we raise on this matter. So that it's a cluster approach and the minister would like this matter to be dealt quickly. We will be presenting to the cabinet committee on the 21st of this month on this matter, Chairperson, so that we have a common approach because the issue of terminally ill and people dying in our facilities are cause for concern. Because we need to be able to have a clear definition from all stakeholders as to what's our definition on this matter. I want to share with your permission to respond on the question of the parole boards. We are appointing new parole boards as we speak. Judging from the quality of the applications of the people who have made appointed to be part of this organization, we are going through the process of identifying the right type of people who will be sitting in the parole board, who understand what the organization is all about, what is the issue around parole process. We also want to indicate that we have instructed the parole committees that it is important that they evaluate their processes and be able to have fair and straightforward approach to matters that are brought forward to them. But another issue that we need to bring to your attention is the issue of re-evaluating the determination of their salary levels. We have indicated in the Collections Week that the Minister will be embarking in opening new parole boards, offices. I should think we have opened excess of about 52, subject to corrections, but 47 parole board offices around the country. So the department is taking the issue of parole very seriously as a matter of principle and also to create avenues for us to be able to deal with the issues of justice correctly. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Baba Zobu, the floor is yours. No. And then you'll be followed by Mr. Leonard Max. Baba Zobu.
No, I'm covered, sir.
Nothing you're covered
anyway. No, I'm covered.
Mr. Max.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to draw the attention of the
committee to page 106, that answer actually Mr. Abrams' point with regard to steps to be taken to reduce overcrowding with regard to the up to 24-month sentences. Just as a remark. The other thing is, Chairperson, and that is the optimum use of staff, page 30 of the document. And I just want to make sure whether the second paragraph is, I understand it properly. At the end of the day, we are sitting with 23,058, say for instance, operational staff to look after the inmates. Is it correct? And then you have to look at 163, almost 164 inmates, 1,000 inmates until the end of the 2009-2010 financial year. And if I'm correct, if it is 23,000, then you people work out the ratio of 1 to 7. And that depends on a calculation if everybody is present. Nobody is sick, nobody is on leave, nobody is on court. Whatever the case may be, it can be increased dramatically if there's an absenteeism and leave, whatever. Then, if you look at the AP, the annual report, then there's a number of issues which could not be conducted or adhered to because of, you people mentioned, a shortage of staff. And then I also read that Treasury said that you people have to reduce staff. Now, here comes my question. This Treasury instruction, Chair, is for me a bit of concern, serious concern. If we look at your escapes, then I must commend operational wise, and I'm talking about operations. I'm busy thinking operational wise. If you look at the stats of how the department curbs escapes, it's commendable. I mean, you know, if you take in consideration the previous year's escapes, where it is now, I mean, this other place escapes is very, very unfortunate, but I'm very pleased that they dealt with it very concise and to the point. And that is that if we are serious that this department should have a turnaround strategy and to address various issues which we are going to deal tomorrow, for instance, with the lack of management and stuff, right? But with regard to your strength, then I would like to know whether the Treasury instruction is based on a proper scientific research, or is it just a sucking thing? You cannot expect the department to do a turnaround because this department had several casualties, ministers as well as commissioners, etc. And this is just a committee's responsibility to criticize, to address, and to support. And the department should indicate to us whether they can cope with this reduction which is being envisaged by Treasury to do their job because already they suffer of a shortage of personnel. So was that instruction based on a scientific research which satisfies the department that they can do so? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leonard Max. Anybody else around staffing matters? Anybody wants to raise any questions about this? Nobody. Yes, Bob.
You know, thank you, Jefferson. When we talk about staffing matters, I read this morning that there was a problem at Ngome over the weekend. I don't know if it's over the weekend or whatever, because of the staffing. I wanted to understand what Max is asking, the oral Max is asking, in consideration of the staffing matter, because what I read in today's newspapers is that the problem was averted because the people who thought that the staffing will be short, but there were a lot of them there. In other words, they all came to work. In other words, if there were not all of them there, that means problems should have escalated to something else. I'm asking this question because of the staffing, sir, because if the staffing, you can't guarantee that a person, everybody will come tomorrow, because anything can happen to the members of the staff. They are only there when they are reporting in the station where they're supposed to. Thank you.
Bamnyanda, followed by Bamgwenya, around staffing matters and those issues. Yes, Bamnyanda.
In the presentation, they mentioned that 41 psychologists in DCS, but the breakdown of psychologists shows that only 36 psychologists in different centers. Where is the other 5 psychologists? What happened to them? That is my first question. The second one, presentation says that official abuse sick leave. How do official abuse sick leave? Can I get a clarity? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, mine is on the staffing in terms of shortage of staff. I'm worried, Chair, if ever the department is going to talk about shortage of staff. Meanwhile, we are talking about prison labor. How are we going to succeed on a prison labor if we've got a shortage of staff? Something is wrong here, Chair. We cannot accept that the department always got shortage of staff. I believe we do have many staff who correctional service. Maybe Uma offices are. There are people need to come down to the center where there is work, more work than the paper. We are not going to implement this prison labor if we're going to talk about shortage of staff. I'm worried about that. I think department needs to improve on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Mr. Max's point, Honorable Max, you know, maybe the department must just give it to us as you see it. In many instances, we are told, especially by organized labor, that this two-shift system is not working. It's not working. You recall we went this route so that we would make savings of about 700 million rand on overtime. That was the motivation. Now, my question is, are we realizing that motivation of saving on overtime? Is this thing working? Is this thing becoming a hindrance? Because Mr. Max is correct. Where we must support you, we can only support you if we are of common mind. If we're not of common mind, we'll go to Treasury and say X, and then we're unable to defend it. So around the staffing generally, just give us what and all, what it is that is ideal for you. Because organized labor gives us a different story in terms of whether it's working or not. I know the minister says in some centers, she's given latitude to heads of centers to use whatever other shifts might be reasonable. Just from you as senior managers, what do you think are the major challenges around this matter? And then with your department, but there's quite a few questions around staffing. If you guys can just give us a good sense around that.
Chairperson, before I cascade the responsibility of responding, I should think what underpins this organization is that we're a labor-intensive organization. And if we start from that premise, then we'll be able to understand the contributions that we shall make here. I can safely say that the limit that is being set by National Treasury is unrealistic and unworkable, because we'll continue coming to this organization speaking about insufficient staff members. There are instances where colleagues, especially those who are in the cold face of business, for example, taking people to court, the security around that, it involves the human element. Chairperson, I'll therefore leave this matter to Ms. Schreiner, Ms. Bond,
and the regional commissioners to provide you with a very high level response to this. But equally, on the question of 41 psychologists, 36 available and 5, I should think we should not lose sight of responding to these matters. Because it underpins the very process of, it underpins the very issue of offender labor. Because if we don't address this matter appropriately, then we will be grilled by your committee. So I'll therefore request Ms. Schreiner and the other colleague to provide responses on this matter. Thanks, Chair.
Chairperson, let me start with the psychologist, because that's an easy one to explain. The 41 psychologists includes people who are permanently employed in psychologist posts and 5 community psychologists. So it's the 36 permanent psychologists plus the 5, and that's how you get to the 41. And apologies that we have not explained that clearly in the documentation. On the issue of the staff utilization, the Commission has already said it very clearly, and let me repeat it. We have indicated to Treasury that we cannot survive, we cannot function with the level of staffing that is envisaged. And it impacts on offender labor, it impacts on security, it impacts on rehabilitation programs. It doesn't matter what aspect of the department's work that you're looking at. We are also in a situation in which we are faced with decisions. Do you deploy people to do asset management and ensure that we get out of qualifications, or do you deploy people to go and work in the centres? It doesn't matter which way you cut the cake. It doesn't fit. I think the critical element when we were interacting with Treasury in November of last year was, and this goes to the question of whether adequate research had been done by Treasury in relation to this. Treasury had benchmarked against the 2 joint venture prisons, the what we commonly call the PPPs, but the 2 existing ones. Our concern is that that is really not an appropriate basis to develop an inmate ratio, an inmate official ratio for the entire department. Those are 2 separate institutions. They do not run the assets of the entire Department of Correctional Services. They do not deal with remand detention. They do not deal with transfers. There are a whole variety of elements of us as a department that you will not find in an isolated prison environment. So we challenged the Treasury in relation to that to say that they were benchmarking against a wrong model. Not only that, but those are facilities that were built recently. We have within our own 241 centres that are extremely old to centres that are highly modern and technology. If you've got a technology-driven centre, you need a different set of staffing from what you need if you've got a really manual facility. If you've got a facility that is built along a central passage and all of the units go off that central passage, your key control is fundamentally different if you've got a centre that is multiple different levels and a complex rabbit warren of passages that come together. Your gate control in that environment is completely different. So what I'm sure Ms. Bond will speak to is the complexity of that inmate official ratio, because it really doesn't help us to generalise it to a 1 to 10, which is what Treasury was putting to us, or a 1 to 7 or a 1 to 4. There's actual complexity. Out of that, what we had agreed was that we really did need, as a department, but with the support of Treasury and the support where necessary of DPSA, to develop an appropriate set of norms around our staffing ratios that would enable us all to be on the same page, so that we are not landing up where we are accused of bloating our staffing figures. When we calculated the officials that we needed on the white paper, we put a ballpark figure of 46,000 officials that we would need. We've then done pretty fundamental structure and function alignment processes. Ms. Bond will provide the figures because I don't have them accurately in my brain, but that escalates from that. That is very carefully looking at the white paper and the capacity that you need to really be able to deliver secure facilities, properly manage remand detention facilities, because your human resourcing requirements in a remand detention facility and a correctional facility can't be measured in the same way. You've got a whole admission and release process in a remand detention facility. You need to deal with that differently. If you've got a center that has a number of further charges of sentenced offenders, you've got escort duties that you don't have in a facility that doesn't. So there's a complexity of the modeling that we don't believe has been adequately taken on board. But the task team, the project that has been set up, is fairly far advanced. If I'm not mistaken, it's addressed in your package, and the timelines are that by the end of this month, we would have a process of that project being able to start delivering information back to us that would then enable between us and Treasury, and obviously with the portfolio committee on board, to have a far more scientific approach to it. I think from my side, those were the processes that I wanted to map about the engagement that we've had with Treasury and our real concern that without a proper staffing of the department, we cannot deliver. The extent to which, and I'm sure the regional commissioners will speak on this, on the real challenges of it. On the 2x12 shift system, I think that we need to be very clear. We are perfectly comfortable that the shift to 7-day establishment is correct and it cannot be backed off from. It is a fundamental enabler of cost savings, so we do not land up with a kind of overtime bill, but in addition, it is particularly important in terms of enabling rehabilitation. But it has to go with proper staffing. It can't enable the structured days, can't enable the delivery of the offender rehabilitation part if it doesn't have the right number of personnel going. We have agreed that we need to structure the shift system appropriate to a particular center because there are complexities. Again, remand detention system has a different type of need for shifts from a center that is running a farm, for example. So we have allowed that flexibility. At a point in time, we will need to sit down as a department and evaluate the variety of the shift systems and then be able to determine, is it one model, is it two or three different models, and that, I think, is worth going forward in terms of refining our optimum use. But perhaps Ms. Bond could speak more on the complexity of the ratios and the project, and then I can see that the regional commissioners want to talk on the impact of the staff shortage.
With regard to the ratios, I think it's covered in our taxi how the different ratios work. For example, for access control, what the ratios are with regard to ground patrol, security fencing. So what would be regarded maybe as a ratio of 1:7 would be fine if you are looking at, for example, the case management, which is 1:30 as a ratio. But if you're looking at, for example, escort duty, a ratio of where you need two members for one offender, that ratio would be inadequate. So we've tried to explain that and to show you what are the approved ratios. We have indicated that we know what our approved ratios are. What we haven't done recently is to assess what is the gap between the approved ratios as well as the current situation on the ground, taking into account the structure, the functions, as well as the requirements for the different shift patterns. So that is a process that we still need to undertake. But as a first step, this process that we want to be done by the 31st of October is to review our staffing requirements. What are our ratios emanating from the request from National Treasury that we indicate as sort of in defense of ourselves, because National Treasury has indicated that we should have a ratio of 1:8, but to explain to them how why we need more staff than we are currently saying. And just in support of the National Commissioner and the CBC OMS, to try and to get ourselves to the levels that we require, we have submitted a bid in the short term just to get us back from the current funding level. Our current funding level is now at 41,500 posts. So we are now trying to get National Treasury to fund us at our previous funding level, which was 46,000 posts. So I think we would request the assistance of this committee to get those at least that funding level.
In the medium to long term, what we've also submitted is a bid for the alignment of structure and functions, as the CDC OMS has indicated, which is an approximately 8 billion requirement. But we are aware of the challenges that the state is facing, and obviously we can't get it all at once. But to get that in a staggered approach to address our requirements, especially for the seven-day establishment. I just want to caution the honourable members from equating the seven-day establishment with the two-shift system, because these are not the same things. So the two-shift system is indeed our ideal shift system in terms of what we want to achieve, but we are aware of the challenges that are being faced in this shift system, and which is why the minister has indicated that in the interim, regional commissioners do have that latitude to determine which shift system they are they can use to deliver the services that are required. So even to give a one model or pattern to all of the centres is a bit of a challenge because of the complexity and the range of different services that are offered. So it's not a matter of a one-size-fits-all, as Ms. Schreiner has indicated. With regard to the abuse of sick leave, there are measures in place, as we've indicated in our presentation, of how we guide, it's a line management function, of how we guide line management with regard to the curbing of the abuse of sick leave. There's also the most, the place that is most open for abuse is the temporary incapacity leave, which is the leave that you use after you've exhausted your sick leave. But now there is, in terms of the pillar process, there is a health risk manager in place that is assessing each and every case where there's an application for temporary incapacity leave, and they will recommend or not recommend an application. And if the area commissioner wishes to deviate from the recommendation of the health risk manager, that can only be done in consultation with the Public Service Commission. So there are systems in place to curb the abuse of sick leave. We are also monitoring it to determine whether there is indeed a spike. There has been a slight increase, and we are sending out measures to the regional commissioners to guide them accordingly. But it is a line management function to do that.
Thank you, Chief. If I can carry on, Mr. Max talked about operational issues. I was smiling. I would like to talk the same language with him. Just on response to what Mrs. Bond said, she said the ratio of escorting a maximum offender, and we must understand ATDs, waiting trials, that he needs work classified as maximums as well. You need two officials. Now, I'm going to use practical examples just to qualify what I'm saying. In the last 5 years, Johannesburg, I never complied with the minimum security standards because I never had the luxury to send two officials with one offender. At BDMP, maximum with high profile offenders, between 50 and 70 a day goes to court and hospital. If there's 122 people, including the heads and the deputies and all administration personnel, how can you confine 140 people to go to court? That's the first issue. Let's come to Mrs. Nguyen. She spoke about the people of the offices must go to the centers for labor. Ma'am, and this is one of the big sore points for us, and as a department we're going to look into is the issue about center base and non-center base. It's part of our package. All officials have the choice, and obviously they all wanted to go center base because it's more moolah. To a certain extent, that all the people working in your offices went to the centers, and they could only go if there's finance vacancies. So you didn't include your people. There's finance vacancies, and they all migrated. To such an extent that most of the area commissioner's office, which was run the administration, and safeguard that we don't get qualified audits with the Auditor General, are under 50% capacity at the moment. And some of them must be now advertised as Public Service Act. So one of the problems we're sitting with the Area Commission is that once you're centre-based, you cannot migrate to a non-centre-based. And when you're non-centre-based now, you can't migrate to centre-based, which creates serious problems. I want to take the second point. We implemented the white paper. What did the white paper say?
besides having security personnel, we needed personnel to do now the case administration, all these issues, the sentence plans, etc. Did Treasury give us extra personnel to do that? No. We took our same security officials working in the unit and we cut them now by a third. So you become case officers. That was never taken care of by Treasury. A white paper that brings a new direction in the department. Before I want to come to practical, Mr. Max, the 2x12-hour shift system, the laborers, they love it. Because you know what? The people on ground level, the officials under the labor, they love the system because half of the time they're off. They work for 2-3 days and then they go moonlight. Security companies, nightclubs, all these things, they come tired to work. They love it, they make a lot of money. But practically, it's a serious problem for them. It's a good system, a 2x12-hour system, but it's very labor intensive. And that 2x12-hour system makes it very, very difficult for us and what Treasury doesn't see. I want to go first. And I think what I'm going to say now, some of the members of the portfolio committee sitting here fully aware of this. At Medium A at Johannesburg, I've got 6,000 this morning, 6,231 awaiting child 18 knees. If Willy Pretoria is that short, Willy Pretoria is the head of the center there with all his staff are together. They're lucky to be 132 this morning. I will take you, Mr. Max, when you come to Johannesburg to A1 and B1 section. If you come there on a Friday morning and you find a unit manager on the rank of a SEO captain that you know in the police, with 7 officials guarding over 1,580 DCs, you are lucky. The members know what I'm talking about. Now, this is reality, Mr. Max. And I want to say that if Treasury doesn't take these things cognizant, they can go back. I know the 2 private centers very well, Mr. Max. I work with them. But they were built in the years 2000, 2010, the modern facilities where you push a button. It's so developed that it's not personnel intensive. Our situation is completely different. Lastly, I want to say that if they really, and I'm not even talking about going beyond these other issues I'm talking, if the 46,500 are being managed down to 41,000, Chair, I'm going to ask for a little time because I'm going to close shop. We won't be able to do that. Thank you.
Chairperson, I should think when we listen to the presentation, there was one poignant request that Ms. Bond made on our behalf, that we need your support to discuss this matter with National Treasury, that it is impossible. It's not based on empirical scientific analysis. And therefore, for us to be able to execute our mandate, we need to be cognizant of the fact that we're a labor-intensive organization and to also take into account that our facilities predate a number of years. Some are old, and therefore, because of the nature of the business that we're involved in, there is no way that we'll be able to deal with the current issues as they are on the establishment that we have. Okay. The current complaints and the challenges that we have are predicated because of shortage of staff. And therefore, the 46,000 or the 41,000 that they want to drop us to is not going to be efficient. It's as good as all of us live in this facility and leave the security and public security to be affected drastically. The fact that we've not had mass escapes and problems in our facility, I should think, is just a mere coincidence because we're stretched to the limits, and it is important, therefore, we get the support that we are requesting. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, Chair, thank you so much. I just want you to ask clarification on with Commissioner Pons, with regards to this discretion which is left with the peace parties or area commissioners to utilize the 2 shifts or whatever. If they don't utilize the 2 shift thing and they use other type of shifts and they include some overtime, who pays? Is the people going to pay for it? We pay for it. And the other one is the commissioner just addressed the issue. Is that my question was there a subsequent meeting with Treasury to explain this particular need and your different viewpoint with regard to the reduction? And lastly, Chairperson for the committee, I think that this is a very, very serious issue. And with personal experience, if you don't have personnel, your command structure collapses. And they took off sick and then you sit there with a corpse. That they should actually, that is a suggestion
provide this committee with a proper detailed documentation, substantiate their case with regards to this particular need. Thanks.
Chair, I have a number of hands lined up here from my team. I have Mr. Smallbeck. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll respond to the part of the overtime which Advocate Max was referring to. The seven-day establishment determined inter alia that officials at centre level need to work 45 hours. Now, that is the baseline. In other words, whether you are working 2 times 12 or 2 times 8, as long as you are working the 45 hours, the approval of the minister to give area commissioners the discretion to deviate from the 2 times 12 is based on several facts. For example, if you have a farm prison where there's a dairy, there's no way the 2 times 12 can work there. When you are having an abattoir, as we have several in the department, it's not possible. Where you have pigs to feed, and I can continue, is not possible. So there's no overtime that we are paying in terms of people who are working now longer hours because of the discretion. If there is overtime, it's totally something different. So there's no leeway that to deviate from 2 times 12 gives you now the opportunity to have an extra salary. Maybe I can also just mention that the reason for the complexity of this matter, we are also having a lot of smaller correctional centers. There's only a few big ones, and the smaller ones is more labor intensive for good reasons. And I think that needs also to be considered. The ideal that was used of the PPPs are bigger places, and the government is expecting also departments to take services to the people, and you need to have the places in rural areas. There must be rural development, and so you will not have one size fit all. Thank you, Chair.
We have a slight challenge. 5 o'clock, the bus leaves. We are interacting with the department again tomorrow on the annual report, again from 2 to 5, but we could split it and have an hour for concluding this matter in 2 hours for dealing with the annual report, or combining both of them, because they both deal with the same matters. But I've received a request that we close business today for those that must carry or must leave by bus. Is it okay with members?
Yes.
All right. We will meet again tomorrow. Commissioner, I'm assuming that most of your team will be here tomorrow. That's not. They're all going to be here. Okay. Not all of them. But we will carry on in the same vein tomorrow and then get on to the annual report in certain instances. Happiness, members?
Yep.
Yep.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the department and to the committee. We'll meet tomorrow.